This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The past couple weeks have been difficult for many Americans. Once again, viral videos emerged of black men and boys being brutalized and killed by police officers. One shows U.S. Army Lieutenant Karan Nazario being assaulted and pepper sprayed by officers while Lieutenant Nazario was wearing his uniform. Another shows Adam Toledo complying with an officer's commands to stop, drop his weapon, and show his hands, only to be shot and killed. Adam was just 13 years old. And in Minnesota, while the officer responsible for killing George Floyd stood trial, 20-year-old Dante Wright was killed by a police officer who had stopped him because of an expired car registration. The videos of each incident have gone viral, but Reggie Jackson hasn't been watching. Jackson is the co-founder of Nurturing Diversity Partners here in Milwaukee, and although he's been paying attention to each incident, he won't watch the videos. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain why.
I'd like to start the conversation with maybe a bit of a personal question, but how are you feeling right now in light of these recent viral videos of police officers once again brutalizing and killing black men?
You know, it's always been difficult for me. I stopped watching the videos. I don't watch the videos anymore. You know, I haven't seen the video of George Floyd. I won't watch the one of Dante Wright. You know, the Army lieutenant who was basically nearly killed back in December, and we just found out about it a few months ago. I just can't watch the videos anymore. They're too traumatic. I wrote an article about just the emotional strain it takes watching these videos constantly. So, you know, from a standpoint of knowing that there's another viral video and then it was released very quickly, you know, I'm glad the police are releasing the body cam footage quicker than they used to in many instances. That's actually, you know, a positive because we don't have to kind of make assumptions and guess about what happened for months and months on end. But it's still, considering what's going on with the Derek Chauvin trial, to have, you know, right up the road from there, to have this young man killed and then for them to come out and say it was accidental. I mean, it's just too much to swallow. And, you know, if that stuff isn't bad enough, you know, there's been multiple stories in the news over the past week of very racist acts at schools. And so we're seeing more of this, you know, among very young people. And it's very depressing, to be perfectly honest with you, Joy.
Yeah. A lot of people, I think, avoid watching the videos of these murders. And there are these kind of opposing feelings as though you should honor this person's life and legacy by watching it and holding people accountable. And then there are the other feelings of this is terrible. These were the last moments of this person's life.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me personally, and I know people that watch the videos, religiously watch these videos. And, you know, I used to watch, you know, I've seen the Eric Garner video multiple times. And, you know, as I've said in the piece I wrote, I've used images of lynching victims. But it's gotten to a point for me personally that it is just too emotionally draining to watch it. And I do want to give credence to the fact that these are the last moments of someone's life. But I see the videos now as snuff films, you know, that you're literally watching someone being killed. And man, it's very difficult. I almost feel that it's gotten to be this thing where we're okay watching someone being killed. And that just seems very strange to me that we're okay. You know, it's fine to watch accounts of these things in movies because you know it's not real. You know, the person didn't actually die. But when it's real, I couldn't imagine in real life seeing a person be killed. I've never seen a person be killed in real life before. I've never seen anything even close to a person even being seriously injured while I was there watching. So to watch a person's life being taken, to see the last moments of them breathing, to hear their cries and, you know, the pain that they're suffering, I just can't do it anymore. It doesn't help me in any way, shape, or form to see the videos. It makes it more difficult for me to accept what happened, because in so many cases we've seen the viral videos and we know that either nothing happened to the police officers or the punishment they received was, you know, really a slap on the wrist. It's just too much for me, Joy.
In one of your essays, and you just mentioned this as well, you compare these viral videos to lynching photographs, which were very common in the earlier part of the 20th century and the late part of the 19th century. When we look at the purpose of lynching photographs and we compare that to these viral videos, how do they stack up?
Well, you know, there's a big difference between the two in terms of the meaning behind them. You know, the lynching photographs of the victims were taken specifically as a keepsake, as a souvenir, as something that the photographer could sell to make money. And people, you know, still hold on to those lynching photographs. They're in a dusty box in the closet that their grandfather or great-grandfather or whomever had, and they passed it down from generation to generation. So those were kept in kind of this morbid sense of remembrance of those events. Whereas these viral videos, you know, they take many forms. You know, some of them are from the police body cam footage, some are from dash cam footage, some are from, you know, cell phones that people who witnessed it took the videos. I think of the man who was shot by the police officer in Charleston, South Carolina, who was running away and was shot in the back. And this person just happened to be there and videotaped it, released it to the media. So I look at it, the purposes are different, but to me, I think that in some ways, because I've seen this in you know, studying what some of the these white nationalists, white supremacists, whatever you want to call these groups, they actually use the videos of Blacks being killed, like Eric Garner choked to death. They're using it as something to laugh about, right? So I know that there are people that have evil intentions that are using it in that way. They're using it in much the same way that those photographs were used as a way just celebrate the fact that whites can really kill Black people willy-nilly and have nothing or very little happen to them. So I know that for people who need to see that proof that provides something for them on a positive level, but I know by the same token, there are people that are out there watching these videos online and they're laughing as these people are dying. And so for me, it's one of those things, it's like a double-edged sword. You know, for the lynching photographs, it wasn't a double-edged sword. It was simply these professional photographers were hired to do a job and they made lots of money. You know, the most famous lynching of all time is the lynching of Dr. James Cameron, the founder of America's Black Holocaust. It's in that lynching that he survived. His two friends, Abram Smith and Thomas Shipp, were killed on August 7, 1930. The photographer who took that photograph, he literally was hired to come to the scene, to pose people in the foreground of the image, to have somebody climb up and cut some branches off of the tree to get a better image. He set up his lights around the bodies to get the best possible view of the lynching victims. And then he made who knows how much money selling, you know, the copies of it. And so it's when we see these videos, it reminds us of the lynching images. That's how many of us in our community feel. They were simply watching the modern day version of a lynching.
Is there a benefit to people seeing these videos of Black men being brutalized, or is it just brutalizing the community and traumatizing the community all over again?
When I think about these videos now, I think about how, not how we as Americans see the videos, but I think about how people in other parts of the world see the videos. And I think people in other parts of the world don't react in the same way that we do. They react with shock and horror. They're just like, wait a minute, this is supposed to be the most progressive, so-called civilized nation on the planet. And we constantly see video after video after video after video of Black people being killed by police. And here in America, we've gotten so accustomed to it that we kind of in some way celebrate it because these videos become viral. And I don't think that it harms us in a way, in terms of efforts to make policing better. I think that it provides more real evidence for people. So in that way, I think the conversations about them have been a positive thing. Look at what happened to George Floyd. I mean, look at all of the protests around the country, around the world about George Floyd. And that wouldn't have happened, you know, 5 years before. So I think that there's progress in terms of how the videos are used, but the traumatizing effect is something people don't think about. Long after these incidents happen, people are still traumatized. The families of George Floyd, the family of Dante Wright, I mean, you saw his mother just exceptionally emotional, trying to talk about what happened to her son. That trauma that we see in that moment when the media is there in the moment, those raw emotions, that doesn't just go away. It's the individual level of trauma. And then the level, it's like when you throw a rock into a body of water, right? And the ripples out. I think that's the trauma that happens and is happening consistently when these videos come out. But we don't talk about that part, Joy. We just say, well, here's another video.
Yeah. Before I let you go, we've been talking, of course, about the trauma these videos cause, and in some ways the conversations they've started, but we're doing this again. It keeps happening. Although we've been talking about police reform for what seems like a lifetime, these things are still happening. What does the death of Dante Wright say about police reform and where it's at right now?
Well, I think it provides further evidence that the reform talk has been nothing but talk for the most part. It hasn't happened really on a state level in many places. It hasn't happened on a federal level. It's happened on kind of a local level. Communities have said we're going to do policing different. You know, they pass policies that don't allow, you know, this police bill of rights to exist anymore. And I've seen some accounts of those things happen. But I think that what it tells people is that, listen, we celebrate protesting, letting our opinions be known about how horrible these things are. You know, we do all this marching and protesting and things of that nature. And we think that that's the cure, but it isn't. The issue with policing is there's a fundamental flaw in the way we police in this country. And it's been a part of the way that we police since policing started, since back in the days when police departments, you know, evolved out of slave patrols. There is this insistence on two things that have been consistent throughout the course of American history when it comes to these issues. Number one is the use of violence. We just accept that the police are violent, right? That they use violent means, that they can use deadly force. We just accept that. Think of other countries. You don't hear about the police being nearly as violent, right? Number two is that Black people have always been treated differently by the police than white people. Everybody knows it. Some people try to deny it and say, oh, no, I don't believe that. Black people are, you know, aren't treated. Listen, even if you say that, even if you believe it on a surface level, you know that there's a part in the back of your mind that says, come on, man, let's be real. We know that there's a difference. We've seen it for decades. We don't need viral videos. When I think about the lack of real reform, it's not a surprise because this is kind of what happens. In the moments that these things happen, there's a great deal of emotion. You know, community leaders, elected officials, police officials, district attorney, everybody says all of the right things generally, right? We're getting more to that point where they're not blaming the victim right away. Now, they may blame him later, but in the moment, they're saying, oh, this is a tragedy, all of those types of things. But what happens is we leave it at that, right? We have a certain level of outward empathy in the moment, but then we lose that because now you're in the trial of Derek Chauvin. You know, his defense attorneys are trying to say that George Floyd is the reason that George Floyd was killed, right? So you lose that empathy over the course of time. And I think with a lot of what's happened in reform efforts, politicians talk a good game, but then they have to actually make those things happen. And they just are not successful, or they do it in such a way that it's not going to be very impactful. It's not going to change the way we police. And I don't care what anyone says about these police reform efforts. You know, people talking about defunding the police and all these other. There's something fundamentally flawed with the way we police. So I think that there is a sense of reform happening by changing laws and things of that nature. It has to be bigger than that. It has to be about changing not only the mindset of police officers, but the mindset of the public when it comes to police officers. We have to stop being okay with this. We have to start demanding that the district attorney's office always charge these officers and not say that, well, you know, we're not going to press charges because we don't think that we can get a guilty verdict. I don't care if you can get a guilty verdict or not. Charge the officers. If they commit something that you consider to be a crime, treat them like you do every other person who commits a crime. And I think that until we do that, until we're honest enough as a society to do that and to accept that, and until people stop putting Blue Lives Matter signs in their yard supporting the police without knowing anything about the victimization of Black people and Native American people and Latinx people and Asian American people by police officers, nothing will change. That is why we've been fighting this fight, talking about police reform and Black Lives Matter, you know, since Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Freddie Gray was killed in Baltimore, you know, Sandra Bland was killed in Texas, all of these things. And here we are, as you said, Joy, we're still having the same conversations all over again because nothing has really changed. Nothing fundamentally has changed because we're trying to fix the wrong thing. We're trying to fix the laws instead of fixing the mindset of policing.
Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, sure, Joy. It's always a pleasure talking with you. It's sad that we talk about sad things, but hey, that's the real world, right? That's the world we're living in. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, always.
Reggie Jackson is the co-owner and lead trainer and consultant for Nurturing Diversity Partners here in Milwaukee, and he's written about these issues for the Milwaukee Independent. Jackson is also this year's recipient of the Carter G. Woodson Award from the National Educational Association and the Association for the Study of African American in History. Jackson spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find some of their previous conversations, including a look at the history of segregation in Milwaukee, at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about the past, present, and future of Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood through a new art exhibit. But first, our Earth Week series continues with a look at programs and initiatives that are underway to make farming in Wisconsin easier on the environment. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Farming is at the core of Wisconsin's culture and economy, but it's also one of the major causes of water quality issues in the state. Earlier this month, a collection of Wisconsin farming and environmental groups released a series of policy proposals to address that. The proposals include funding well replacements or filtration systems, as well as incentives for farmers to plant cover crops, which help to improve the soil, among other environmental benefits. As a part of our Earth Week series, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz is exploring the significance of the farming and conservation collaboration. Margaret Crome is the policy program director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, where she focuses on federal and state programs. She spoke with Susan about how agricultural policy can be blended with conservation.
Last year, there was a group of water quality bills that went through, and we had a couple of programs that were really important in that, one of which would reduce by $5 per acre the amount of money that farmers pay for their crop insurance if they plant cover crops. So for on cover crop acres, you could get a reduction in your crop insurance premium. And that is a program that started in Iowa, has been now expanded to Illinois, and we want it here in Wisconsin. And we got it through so many of the hoops, through the ag committees in both chambers, through the full assembly, unanimously in all cases, joint finance, unanimous passage, and then COVID stopped the Senate. So we would really like to see that again, and we want to make sure we have funding to cover the staffing. That the Department of Ag's staff is just depleted. And so we need to have the program and the staffing that can accompany it. Also at the state level, we need to have more funding for grazing. Grass is covering the ground. That's one of the essentials of a good soil health. And we have that in pasture. So having more support for grass-based agriculture And we want a grazing coordinator. We'd like to see grants at the state level to support grazing. And similarly, at the federal level, one of the most important things we could do would be to get funding for the Grazing Land Conservation Initiative, which supports technical assistance. That is, it helps farmers create grazing plans and implement grazing plans. It pays for things like farmer conferences and for groups of farmers together to form a network of grazing farmers to share experiences and discuss questions and problems and troubleshoot. Those kinds of initiatives, they will make the difference.
So when it comes to existing programs that, again, support farming and those practices, well, any best practices will always factor in water, right? I mean, that means you've got a good program. What's out there that's working, both at the state and federal level?
At the federal level, we have some terrific programs where farmers can get financial support for undertaking good conservation practices. One of them is called EQIP. It stands for Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and it's run through USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS. And another of those NRCS programs for farmers working on their lands is called the Conservation Stewardship Program. And it's really aimed at trying to help reward farmers for doing the right thing and then offering some incentives for even doing more. That program is another terrific program. We have, at the state level, the tremendous amount of money goes to support and is desperately needed in every single county to support farmers doing good cost share. That is, doing good conservation practices through what's called cost share. So we have county conservationists at the state level in every county. And those county conservationists, so the people who work with farmers to evaluate what the problems are, to decide what kinds of practices make sense, to help find funding to support them. And those are very important conservation programs. I think people across the state recognize how important conservation is and how important county conservation staff are to its success. Those are the folks you go to when there's a problem. Those are the folks you turn to for advice. Those are the folks who can help you find solutions and find funding to correct a problem. So those kind of technical assistance at the farm level, that's really, at the county level, that's just really important. And we do have growing support for that program and should.
Did you cover, do you think, all of what's out there at the state and federal level?
There's only one other federal program that I would want to speak to. The Conservation Reserve Program is an example of a program that says not every piece of ground ought to be farmed. There is land that really is too fragile to be farmed, and that land should be set aside, and it is set aside in the Conservation Reserve Program. That's one of the principal federal strategies for doing it. And that's really important. Of course, one other program strategy is farmland preservation. Just saying we need to make sure we have farmland, period, and doing whatever we can to make sure we protect that land so it can continue to be productive land. And of course, I already mentioned the critical role of the Grazing Lands Conservation Initiative. That is really critical. And it illustrates something. I said that money was for conservation technical assistance. So that's the other point that I would make at the federal level. We need money for boots on the ground. We need money that can be used to help make sure we have conservation staff in our counties able to help farmers. We have, in some years, we've gotten money at the federal level for programs, but there weren't enough staff to actually implement it. And, you know, that's a terrible place when staff, we cannot do the thing we're trying to do because we don't have enough boots on the ground. So that's really critical. We are very strongly supporting increases in conservation technical assistance.
So, Margaret, what is the significance, or is there a significance in the Dairy Business Association and the conservation groups, Clean Wisconsin and Nature Conservancy, who step forward and say, we're going to work together on policy? I mean, do you think this can go somewhere?
I think it's so exciting. It's a statement that the farming groups who are participating are saying, our heads are fully pointed toward problem solving. We want to recognize that we do have some problems. We want to do it constructively, and we trust these partners to work with us, to be constructive and create solutions. I love that. I just think it is exactly where our planet and our communities and our individual farmers should be looking to get leadership. That's the attitude that brings us the kinds of solutions that really help people at all levels. When you invest in conservation, you are actually literally investing. You can save, we can save taxpayers big money when we put money into conservation. For example, when I drive out in Southwest Wisconsin and I drive along a ridge and after a tremendous storm and I look down and I see signs that say road closed, it's because the water didn't infiltrate into the soil. They were not using soil health practices. The water tore off the land, tore down the hillside, tore out the roads, the bridges, the culverts. That is really costly to repair. And when you use soil health practices, not only are you keeping the soil for farmers and for future generations, keeping water against the droughty periods that are going to come later in the year, we know, we're avoiding major taxpayer costs. And I think that we should be always conscious of the big picture costs. We can save so much money in avoided costs if we invest in good conservation practices.
Margaret Crome is the Policy Program Director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute based in East Troy. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz as a part of our Earth Week series. Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood served as an economic and cultural center of the Milwaukee African American community for decades before highway construction systematically destroyed the neighborhood beginning in the 1960s. In his new exhibit at the UWM Union Art Gallery, Milwaukee artist Mutobe Johnson explores the past, present, and future of Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood. The exhibit, In Search of a Benevolent Kind of Blue, brings to life the vibrant Bronzeville culture while grappling with the cultural loss and negative impact of eminent domain policies in the neighborhood. Johnson celebrates the Bronzeville of old while looking towards the future of the neighborhood. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with Johnson about his personal history with Bronzeville.
Where did the idea for this Bronzeville series come from, and what is your personal relationship to Bronzeville?
I was actually born and raised in Bronzeville, and so it serves as a reference point for me. I mean, culturally, and the significance really is a very personal exploration. It was really in the back of my mind, you know, for a while. It didn't really surface until I ended up coming back to grad school a little bit later in life. And while I was in grad school, I was going through a series of writing exercise with some of my professors. And so the thought of tapping into some of our own personal experiences was really the assignment. And I was avoiding it for a while because I didn't want to get too personal. I didn't want to make it seem as though that I was selling my own history or selling my own personal story. So I avoided it. But I kind of talked around it for a while. And so in some of my writings, some of those stories began to come out, childhood experiences. And the professor I had at the time really challenged me and said, well, you know, you should find a way to bring some of that into your work. And so we've collectively kind of figured out a way that, okay, I could still be personable and not make it personal. So I thought, okay, what if I make the story of Bronzeville kind of a case study and then do it as a comparison to other Black Belt communities across the country that experience some of the things that the citizens of Bronzeville experienced. And then that was my entree to a visual concept that led to a narrative that I could share that became a broader focus on what Bronzeville represents today. And that's how it happened.
Can you paint us a picture of the Bronzeville that's depicted in your artwork and in this exhibit? What does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it feel like? And how did you get an understanding of that through maybe research?
I see myself as a character witness. Being a kid in Bronzeville, having to live there, the games that we played when there was no television or computers to focus on. You know, outside was something that was, it was a regular activity. You know, we played games during the day and at night. Where I live across from St. Francis Church, you know, on 4th and Brown. My home no longer exists because I think part of that, you know, redevelopment raised a lot of the homes that were there. A lot of businesses were lost. But I played on that playground at St. Francis. I learned to ride a bike that was too big for me. From that kind of memory to watching the Franciscan monks go to prayer and the sisters from the convent go to prayer, and then the services that were held, it was, you know, we interfaced with them all the time.
Yeah.
Bronzeville was the kind of community where you didn't have to leave to go anywhere to get goods and services. You know, it was one of those moments where the doctor made house calls.
Uh-huh.
If you wanted to go and get any food or things relevant to the household, it was right there. We very seldom had to go downtown because the way that the city had zoned the area, most of the African-American residents that lived there, many of them didn't own homes. They rented mostly. And so we learned to adapt. We learned to cohabitate and grow together as a community. You know, I've seen it, I heard it, and those things never leave you. They help build character. It was the one thing that helped me with my visual recollection of the place.
So when people see this exhibition, there's the theme of Bronzeville tying the works together.
Yeah.
But there's also a more obvious visual connection, which is also in some of your other work, which is the blue pigment that appears. How did you come to use, I guess, indigo pigment in your work? And what does it mean for this exhibit?
Like most artists, we explore color as a theme or as a visual voice. And I wanted to try and find a way to connect these things that I was experiencing through my research and through paying homage to people that came before us. And actually, in the beginning of some of the work I created, I was actually working in sepia tone. And then I thought, well, let me go a step further and look at what other colors that translated. And so blue happened to stick with me. And what punctuated it was, I had an opportunity to go visit some friends in South Carolina. While we were there, you know, my wife came to me and said that, well, we're thinking about visiting one of the historic plantations here. What do you think about going? And I initially said, I'm not interested. I didn't come all the way down to South Carolina to visit no plantation. And so the more we thought about it, because, you know, we had our kids in tow, we thought, well, it might be a good experience for them. And when I got there, we were on the plantation. They covered various areas of the cash crops that they grew there. And lo and behold, it was the site where they grew indigo, the plant itself. And then all of a sudden, bingo, it hit me. The lineage all came clear. The struggle of the slaves that grew it. History sort of flashed right before me, the connectivity between cotton that grew in the fields next to it and how the two became one. And so the blue indigo pigment became a story that is tied to America's story. And the history of the pigment can be linked to, you know, royalty. It can be linked to the textile industry, Levi Strauss, and when the Union Army uniforms, the blue, it became laced with narratives that would give me a treasure trove of subject matter. And of course, everybody can relate to the blues.
Yeah. Many people think of the blues as a musical genre, but for you, the blues is also a visual medium. And in the exhibit, there's music playing in the background for those that can go in person.
Yes.
How do those work together for you, the musical and the visual, not just in this exhibit, but in your work more broadly as you think about the blues?
These connections with the cultural significance of the pigment blue and the other cultural connections become a visual language, but also an audio connectedness too. And so when you walk into the space, you get a chance to see the images as they're meant to be interpreted, but also with having an audio connection to it really kind of encompasses the experience. And so I have to give credit to Emily Hankins, for the curator of the space of the Union Art Gallery, and the staff there. So the way that they embraced the exhibition was to really look at not just my work, but they wanted the viewer to really take it in too. And so to add the audio to it really fulfills the experience if you have an opportunity to go in and see it in person.
So some of the figures you paint in these cool shades of blue, white, and purple.
Yeah.
It made me feel like these people and their stories were ghosts in a way, kind of forgotten by the city and maybe no longer containing that vital life force. Is that something you intended?
Well, not from a ghostly standpoint.
Okay.
Well, certainly from a standpoint that says that we don't want the memories of those that came before us to be forgotten.
Yeah.
The only sense of loss there is what happened, you know, to the neighborhood when it was thriving and at a peak time in history where, you know, it was culturally rich with culture that you can't go to the store and buy anymore.
And maybe you never could, you know.
Well, you never could. That's, you know, so this, you know, the whole idea of culture happening naturally, it happened organically. I kind of poke fun at it a little bit. I have some oatmeal cereal boxes that with my face on it as the, you know, the Quaker Oats guy.
Yeah.
That simply says, this is Bronzeville grit with an S, you know, after the exclamation point. But nevertheless, it's not Instamix. Culture, you just can't go and buy it off the shelf and voila, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So it comes about naturally. And that's basically my intention. So that ghostliness of what's missing is the Bronzeville of old. And I try to memorialize the Bronzeville of old while celebrating the 21st century Bronzeville, which I think is where a lot of the politicians and the Bronzeville bid, the Martin Luther King bid, is all involved in trying to give us a 21st century Bronzeville.
Yeah. So getting into that, I mean, your whole exhibit is a memorial to the Bronzeville of old, but it also has an eye towards the future.
Absolutely.
Where does your exhibit fit into that current conversation about the future of Bronzeville?
One of the things that I tried to do was to look towards many of my contemporaries. You'll see many of them in the paintings. The individuals that are in some of the large works that I refer to as the Bronzeville Poet Series are people who are living, breathing, have connections to Bronzeville as we speak. Tiffany Miller is an example, poet, young entrepreneur, businesswoman, got her stakes in Bronzeville right now. She's blooming. And then there are other poets that are connected to not just the paintings, but connected to Bronzeville in some sort of way. They're resident Milwaukeeans. Mikhail Pruitt, there's Carmen McGee, there's Blanche Brown, Eric Jefferson. So there are at least six individuals connected to those paintings. And each of them live, work, and express themselves here in Milwaukee. And so that's one way of contemporizing it and making connections as to what's happening like right now.
Thank you, Mutope, for sharing your blues with us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, and, you know, just shout out to all my Bronzeville peeps. Thank you.
Mutope Johnson is a visual artist based in Milwaukee. His exhibit, In Search of a Benevolent Kind of Blue, is on display at the UWM Union Art Gallery. In-person viewing is currently restricted to UWM students and employees, but you can check out links to the virtual gallery online at wuwm.com. Coming up next, the novel Send For Me explores life in Nazi Germany and the struggle to escape through real letters from the author's grandmother. We'll hear from the author next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Few voices are left from the generation that witnessed and experienced the Holocaust. But the effect of these horrors remain potent for their descendants, grappling with the terror and eerie mundanity of life in Nazi Germany. In her book, Send For Me, author Lauren Fox explores what life was like for Jews in Germany as the Nazis took control of the country. The story is told through several time periods, connecting the lives of four generations of women. A mother, desperately trying to find a way out of Nazi Germany, writing to her daughter, who escaped to Milwaukee. A granddaughter, brought to Milwaukee as a child, and her child, discovering the letters that unlocked her family's history. Although the story is fictional, the letters are real, taken verbatim from the letters Fox's grandmother sent her daughter in Milwaukee. Fox joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers last month to talk about the book and the letters that inspired it.
So these are letters that have been with you for a long time, for your lifetime. In many ways, they're a part of your origin story. Why was now the right time to write this story?
Oh, that's a really good question, and I have to answer it in a long-winded way. So, because I started working on the story when I found the letters, like 25 years ago. I was getting my master's degree in creative writing from the University of Minnesota when I found the letters. And so after I had them translated, well, sort of alongside the process of having them translated, I started working them into a memoir. It was my master's thesis, but I feel like it was kind of a sort of a failed project. Memoir wasn't my genre. I was kind of too young, I think. So I put them aside for a long time. I did a bunch of other things. I wrote some other novels. And then about 5 years ago, you know, I think the first kind of moment when I felt like I needed to return to this story was when we learned about the Muslim ban that was put into effect. And I mean, things were so horrible in this country, but that was a moment for me when I thought, oh my God, the past is with us. We haven't learned from our mistakes. And this is the moment when I need to start thinking about this story again. And then of course, we were also seeing around the same time, images of children being separated at the border. And it just it all felt, you know, horrifying and too resonant. And it kind of just made me feel like, okay, now's the moment.
It is in some way, it's not a fictionalized version of your life, but it's a fictionalized version of parts of your life, I guess. Why did you decide to write it in this way instead of writing something that was nonfiction?
I had attempted to write this story as a memoir to kind of like work through and understand how the letters and how my family's history, you know, moved through the generations and came to fruition in me. But I feel like I'm not really a memoirist. And a few people had to remind me that I had actually written three novels. And then in fact, I'm a novelist and fiction is more my genre. And also it just felt like in a world where Holocaust deniers exist, right? In a world where like anyone could ask the question, you know, did the Holocaust happen? I feel such an obligation to tell the truth. So that kind of stymied me for a long time because I felt like the only way to tell the truth was through memoir. But I realized I could stay true to the story. The letters that appear in the novel are, I made a promise to myself that those letters I wouldn't change a thing. Those are the words of my great-grandmother. But the story needed to be fiction. I couldn't get into the thoughts and hearts of my actual relatives. I could only imagine what they were thinking and feeling. And also the letters shined a light on those aspects, but I couldn't write it as a true story. I needed to write it as a novel. And I also feel like I only figured this out recently. I kind of feel like I was having a conversation with those letters. Like my great grandmother would say something in the letters like, you forgot your coat, or like, if I don't remember everything, this is what happens. And so I could sort of construct a scene around those little snippets that she offered me. And I could write a whole story about the two characters going coat shopping, you know? So I was able to me, that's like the pleasure of fiction, to sort of imagine the stories based on these kernels of truth.
That part of the book really spoke to me. I grew up with a woman who was like my grandmother. She was a young Jewish woman living here in Milwaukee during the Holocaust. And since her passing, I've thought a lot about these questions that I didn't ask her, that I wish I would have. Sensitive things that, you know, never feel appropriate. What was it like for you exploring these questions, these ideas, these stories through your book?
Well, my grandparents really didn't talk about it. I think that, you know, people process trauma in different ways. And, you know, some people, I think, talk about it and really tell those stories, and some people suppress them. And my grandparents, I think they were trying to protect us. I think they were just, you know, they were really loving, wonderful people. They weren't, you know, it's not like the repressed issues like came up in any way. They just, I think, made the decision not to talk about the really hard, sad things they had been through. You know, they would offer me little snippets, kind of little anecdotes here and there. So I knew a few things. My mom is open to talking about it. She was a baby when she came here, so she doesn't have any memories of that experience. So for me, it was like, I knew that this was my history. Like, I knew where they had come from, and of course knew the larger history, but it was never a conscious thing growing up. I never knew the whole story. And the letters that I discovered don't really tell the story. Like, they weren't my great-grandmother's attempt to tell me a story. They were letters that she wrote as she was trying desperately to leave Germany. So I feel like I was constructing this fictionalized version of their story based on little bits and pieces and little things I had heard and little like things that I knew about that particular era. But it was like a really satisfying and difficult and emotionally draining process for me to build this story up from the small pieces that I knew.
With that in mind, this book actually required a lot of historical research, it seems. What was it like digging into these parts of often everyday history that are in many ways a part of your life's story?
I mean, it's strange to say that I loved doing the historical research, but I found it so satisfying. I really enjoyed that part of the process. You know, I was kind of writing and researching at the same time. I was like, you know, I would like come up with a question and then I would go to my books or go to the internet and just find the little details of, you know, I would be like, what kind of shoes would a woman have been wearing in 1933? And I could kind of go down the rabbit hole for, you know, an entire day looking at like different shoe styles of the 1930s. So that stuff I found really enjoyable. I've never written historical fiction before. So to me, that was illuminating and very cool. And of course, it was a, you know, difficult time to be researching. So, I mean, there were challenges and it was, you know, it was hard to sort of put myself in the position of imagining my relatives during this horrible time in global history. So, you know, it had its challenges for sure, but I found it like, it really, like immersing myself in that history really gave me the confidence to write this book.
You mentioned earlier, you used your great-grandmother's words verbatim. Why was that so important to you?
Well, like I said before, I feel like I made this promise to myself that I wouldn't change her words, because that to me is like the beating heart of the book. It's the like authenticity of the book weaving through it. Like I said, she wasn't trying to tell me a story. She was just trying to get out of Germany. And I feel like, you know, quoting her words was like inviting her to be a part of, inviting her into this story and allowing her to be the voice of this story. You know, like so many people are, we're losing so much of the generation that remembers the Holocaust is already gone. And so I feel like that too was a piece of it for me. I feel like opening myself up to that obligation to the truth and weaving it through my story felt like the right move.
There are so many people from that generation who are dying right now, have already died. Most of the people who are still alive were children at the time. You would have had to be. What do you think is the obligation, not just of people whose families endured the Holocaust, but of all of us who know these stories? What do you think our obligation is?
I mean, I'm not the first person to say that, you know, our obligation is to remember these stories. And I think it's also to live in the world as ethical people who know our history and do whatever we can to prevent history from repeating itself. There's some study came out, I can't remember specifically, but a huge percentage of, I think it was millennials, don't know how many people died in the Holocaust. They like have estimates from like, you know, 1 million to 3 million. I feel like, you know, we're losing so much of that. And it's really important to do whatever we can to illuminate the truth.
Lauren Fox is a novelist based in Shorewood and the author of Send For Me. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last month. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on the show, Attorney General Josh Call joins us to talk about new funding that will help the State Department of Justice better track sexual assault evidence kits. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.